From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We're ending 1991 with interest rates very low. The Fed has slashed interest rates, hoping it will get us out of the recession. This may be a good time to take out a loan, but it's a bad time for collecting interest on savings accounts and CDs. On today's Fresh Air, personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn helps us make sense of some disorienting changes. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reveals his choices of the best films of the year. And for those of you watching Spartacus on TV, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg explains why the Romans in Hollywood epics sound British while the slaves are ethnic Americans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is on his way to the Far East, where he hopes to open up Asian markets to U.S. goods. As Barry Schwide reports, the focus of this once-delayed trip has changed.
What started out as an exotic trip chock full of photo ops is now serious business, and there are serious businessmen traveling with the president. Their goal is to get Japan to open its markets more widely to American exports. Given Americans' appetites for Japanese imports, try to restrict deliveries from Japan haven't worked well. So the Bush approach is to expand U.S. exports, hoping thereby to narrow the $42 billion-plus trade imbalance with Japan. Some Bush aides are taking a tougher line than the president, thereby permitting him to look both firm and judiciously moderate. Just tough enough, the president's political handlers hope, to defuse political critics here at home and to persuade Americans who have lost their jobs that the president is looking after America first and that he has America's interests at heart when he goes abroad. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
There's been intense fighting reported in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, the Armenian enclave in the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. Russian television said 15 people were killed yesterday in fighting between the Azeri militia and Armenian guerrillas. The fighting's been going on for the past 4 years, but it's always been repressed to some extent by the Soviet army. Now that the Soviet Union no longer exists, the peacekeeping forces are gone. Azerbaijan's president said today in Minsk that he's prepared to resume peace talks with Armenia. Moscow television said today that the Azeri president prevented the issue from being debated at today's Commonwealth meeting in Minsk, saying it was an internal matter. Floodwaters continue to threaten thousands of people in southeast Texas. This month, severe flooding has claimed at least 16 lives across the state. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF in Houston reports.
Residents along the lower Brazos and Trinity Rivers outside of Houston have been playing a guessing game for several days. About a week ago, North Texas was inundated with heavy rain and flooding. Now that water is headed toward the Gulf of Mexico, but no one can predict how soon it will arrive or how high the water will get. Many residents have come up with their own measurement systems, like Penny Wells, who runs a homeless shelter near the Brazos River.
Last night it came back up to the 3 feet. From evacuation point for us, which means it would then be running in our buildings. And it is staying. It's consistently there. Now, that could change tonight.
The Brazos is expected to crest 2 feet above flood stage, while the Trinity River may be 6 feet above its banks by Thursday. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 62 points to close at a record 3,163.9. This is NPR News. Mother Teresa has been hospitalized for pneumonia and heart failure in La Jolla, California. The 81-year-old Catholic nun became ill on the last leg of a worldwide tour of Missionaries of Charity facility. She's internationally known for her work with the charity in India. Hospital officials said that doctors performed a balloon angioplasty on Mother Teresa yesterday to clear blockages in her arteries. After a 6-month college desegregation trial, a federal judge has ruled that Alabama must erase all forms of racial discrimination in its higher education system. Paula Lynn of Peach State Public Radio reports.
The ruling from U.S. District Judge Harold Murphy of Rome, Georgia, is meant to help end racial bias at Alabama State University at Montgomery and Alabama A&M University at Huntsville. Murphy says the state's funding formula must be improved to help these universities achieve their goals at the mostly black campuses. One calling is for an end of program duplication between the two schools and other white neighbor institutions. Another is to increase the number of black faculty and administrators. Other schools are also affected by the employment rulings, such as Auburn University, the University of Alabama, University of Montevallo, Livingston University, and Calhoun State Community College. For National Public Radio, I'm Paula Lynn in Atlanta.
An Italian investigator said today that Soviet nuclear material is being offered for sale to countries that are interested in building or acquiring nuclear weapons. Romano Dolce is an assistant public prosecutor in the northern Italian town of Como. He claims to have learned about the sales while investigating the seizure of a sample of plutonium in northern Italy last October. Dolce told Italian state television that proof of the trafficking was established when Swiss police seized 66 pounds of Soviet uranium last month. A Milan newspaper charged that former agents of the Soviet KGB were smuggling nuclear material abroad to raise cash. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This has been a year of declining interest rates. That's good news if you're taking out a loan, but it's bad news if you rely on interest from your savings account or CDs. So what are we supposed to do? We invited personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn to discuss the impact low interest rates might have on our spending and saving, and if we should consider changing the habits we created when interest rates were higher. Quinn writes for Newsweek and is the author of Making the Most of Your Money. The biggest single cut in interest rates came earlier this month when the Federal Reserve slashed its bank discount rate from 4.5% to 3.5%. The Fed is hoping that low interest rates will help end the recession.
When you lower the rate of interest, what you are trying to do is cut the burden of debt, which will give people more money to spend, more money to invest. Generally, lower interest rates are supposed to encourage borrowing. They're supposed to help jumpstart the economy. And this is what they are hoping to do. But so far, it hasn't worked. As you know, the Fed has been pushing interest rates down drastically for more than a year now, and it has not jumpstarted the economy. Because what happens is when people look at the lower interest rates, instead of going out and borrowing more money, they do just what you and I are going to talk about here. What they do is they go out and they say, this is great. This is going to save me money. Now I can pay down my debt even faster.
So let's look first at some of the things that you could maybe take advantage of now with the lower interest rate. Is this a good time to buy a new home?
Well, it's a terrific time to buy a house for anybody who is lucky enough to have the down payment, of course. But if you have the down payment or if you're shopping for a house, I mean, house prices have been flat to down in many parts of the country, and interest rates or mortgage rates are now extremely low. I have seen some adjustable rate mortgages that for the first year they have been charging under 5% for the first year's rate. I mean, this is staggering. We haven't seen this in, what, 15 or 20 years. So rates are really low. Does this mean they won't go lower? I don't know. Maybe they will go lower. But when you are looking at whether you should buy a house or not, or how much mortgage rates are, you should really look at the time, say, what can I afford? If I can afford it now, how can you speculate? You don't know if rates are going to go up or down tomorrow. So if you can afford it, I say do it. It's a terrific time to get a mortgage.
Now, say you bought a house at a much higher interest rate. What are the considerations in refinancing a house?
Well, two things here. First is that you should look at refinancing if the new rate on the mortgage is at least 2 percentage points lower than the rate that you have on your mortgage today. So, but this also depends here on the kind of loan you have. If you have an adjustable rate mortgage, as I do, for example, my mortgage rate went down automatically by 1.5 points starting January 1st is when it goes. And so with an adjustable rate mortgage, if you adjust once a year, it's going to happen automatically and you don't have to go out and pay the upfront cost that it does cost to refinance a loan. On the other hand, many people who have adjustable rate mortgages don't like them because they don't like the fact that the payment changes every month, and they are looking to refinance into a fixed rate mortgage. And this is really a very good time to do that. But look, you want the mortgage rate to be 2 percentage points lower. You also have to look at the upfront costs. And you say, how much is it going to cost me to refinance this loan because there are all these charges up front? And then you say, how much is this going to save me every month? And you see how long it's going to take you to break even. With the savings on your monthly payments, how long it will take them to equal the cost that you pay to refinance your mortgage up front. And then you say, how long am I going to be in the house? And if typically you want to recover the cost of refinancing in at least 3 years.
Okay, so the lower interest rates can be helpful if you're looking to buy a home, if you're considering refinancing a mortgage. Who else can be helped? And I'm talking about consumers right now.
Well, any borrower in most cases is helped by lower interest rates. Obviously, if you have a credit card whose rate is stuck at 19.8% or 20 or 21%, you're not going to be helped. A lot of the banks that are keeping their interest rates high, they're just not giving you a break at all on these credit cards. But what you see happening all over the country is that more and more credit cards are coming out with lower interest rates. They just have not been able to succeed. Competition has forced the interest rates down. Anybody who has an average credit rating today ought to be able to get a credit card at 15% interest on unpaid balances. It's just there's no sense at all paying these 19.8% rates. So you should be able to look around. Credit unions very often have cheaper cards. Local banks have cheaper cards, maybe local SNLs. It's most of the big national banks are the ones that still are charging 19.8%. The ones that send you the thing in the mail that say, just sign here and we'll give you a credit card, those are usually expensive banks. And if you look to a local bank, you ought to be able to swap that credit card. I'd make that a New Year's resolution.
My guest is Jane Bryant Quinn. Her latest book is Making the Most of Your Money. And we're talking about what these lower interest rates mean, how they can be helpful, and also how they can hurt you. And, of course, one way they can hurt you is in your savings account. The lower interest rates for borrowers also means that people with money in their savings account are getting lower interest rates there, too. How much lower are they on the whole? Can you estimate?
It's terrible. You have a whole group of people, especially older people, who are the largest savers in this country, who had certificates of deposit. Maybe they had a 5-year CD, and they might have been getting, 8, 7, 8, 9, even 10%. Just a few years ago, and suddenly they're turning around and they want to turn it over, and they see 4, 5, 6%. So they're seeing the income in some cases from their savings cut in half. And this is very drastic for people in this position, because the older you are, the more apt you are to have a significant portion of your income come from savings account interest. And all of a sudden, your income is being chopped, and you don't really have any way of recovering that. So this is a real problem for savers.
So I guess the people worst affected are people who are retired and maybe sold their home and put the money in the savings account or in CDs, hoping to live on the interest, and now there isn't much interest.
That's right. And one of the things it shows, by the way, is that a lot of people for many years were able to get a really terrific return on their savings just by keeping it in 1-year certificate of deposits or 1-year treasury securities. And they just turned it over every year, or even in money market bank accounts or money market mutual funds. 100% safe. They turn their money over every year. They had their money constantly available, and they still had a high interest rate. So they never thought to themselves, gee, maybe I should try to capture this interest rate for a longer period of time. So they kept their money in the money funds, or they kept all their money in 1-year CDs, and then rates just dropped precipitously, and now they are stuck, as opposed to people who said, gee, I don't need to keep all my money in short-term investments. I can put some of it in a 5-year CD, or I can put some of it in a 10-year treasury. The people who put their money out for longer periods of time are still getting higher interest rates on it.
Is it worth buying CDs anymore, taking out CDs?
Well, sure, it's worth taking out CDs. Again, I would try to take out a longer-term CD rather than a short-term CD.
Okay, so you take out a longer-term CD but for 5 years, but the next year the interest rates climb back up again. Cheating yourself,
aren't
you?
But here again, Terry, you see, you can't predict. See, this is what everybody said before. They kept saying, well, next year interest rates are going to climb again, so therefore I'm going to keep my money in a short term, and it didn't work out for them. What you need to do is say, when do I need this money back? If this is money that I'm going to need 6 months from now, okay, fine. I'll keep it in a money market account. Well, you have to keep it in a money market account even if rates are low. On the other hand, if you say, you know, this is money that I really am not going to need to spend for 5 years, then it should be in a 5-year certificate of deposit. And if you do what you call, say, laddering your safe investments, you've got a portion of it in a money fund, you have some in a 1-year CD, you have some in a 2.5-year CD, you have some in a 5-year CD, then you've kind of covered all your bases. Because if rates go up, well, you've got this in the money fund that's going to increase your income. If rates go down, well, you've got that 5-year CD that is going to keep on giving you today's income rather than lower income of next year. This is the kind of strategic thinking that you have to apply to your savings and that people just haven't done because rates were so high, they just shut their minds down and said, well, 1-year CD is fine for me.
If you're keeping your savings in a savings account, how badly are you doing right now?
Well, if you're talking a passbook account, you know, some passbook accounts are still at 4.5%, 4.75%. Again, it depends on your bank. But you might be getting actually even under 4% in some cases. You might be getting 3.5% or 3.75%. A bank in New York is paying, well, this is on a checking account, they're paying 2.5% on their on the Now accounts, the interest-paying checking. So you are getting extremely low rates after taxes and after inflation. A lot of these accounts are probably not returning any money at all to people. It's just dead flat.
You know, it seems like the ultimate squeeze with the low interest rates. Say you bought a home or even a car at a really high interest rate. Well, that interest rate is going to stay high. You're going to keep paying off at that high rate. In the meantime, if you have money in your savings account or even in a certificate of deposit, that interest rate is going down. So you're making less money, but you're still paying the high interest rate.
There are some adjustable car loans, although most people don't have them. One thing I think people should consider doing, by the way, if you say, my interest rate is so low, I'm only getting 4% on my savings. How can I make my savings worth more? Well, here's a way of making your savings worth more. Use it to pay off a 15% debt. I mean, it is just crazy today to have money in your savings account at 4%, earning 4%, while you've got 15 or 18 or 19% on your credit card that's costing you that much money. You should take your savings, use it to pay off your debts. And then you can start, then the money that you aren't paying every month to pay off debts, you can put back and start raising your savings again. It would be a very smart idea for people who have a lot of savings to get rid of these high rate debts that you're talking about. Wipe them out.
What about bonds? How are bonds doing now?
Well, again, interest rates on bonds have come down as well, although on the longer you can put your money out, the higher the interest rate you get. Now, people who are in higher brackets, say a federal tax bracket of 28% or higher, and especially if you live in a high-tax state, municipal bonds are looking very attractive because their interest rates generally have not come down as fast as other interest rates have. But here is the thing about bonds. The highest interest rate you can get on bonds is on a bond that is a 30-year bond. But this is also a risky kind of investment because you probably aren't going to hold that bond for 30 years. You're going to want the money sometime before 30 years is up, and that means you'll have to sell the bond before maturity. When you go to sell a bond before maturity, maybe if interest rates have risen, you'll lose money on it. And so a bond that you buy now and expect to sell before maturity becomes a risky investment. If you want a safe investment, you have to buy a bond that you know you are going to hold until its maturity date and then cash it in. And so to me, that says that when you are buying bonds, I wouldn't buy a bond that's any more than a 10-year investment. If you're going to run a risk, you should buy mutual funds that invest in stocks because over longer periods of time, they do better than bonds. If you don't want to run a risk, you should buy a medium-term bond, and medium-term is anything from 5 to 10 years.
My guest is personal finance expert Jane Bryant Quinn. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the impact of low interest rates with Jane Bryant Quinn. She writes about personal finance for Newsweek, and she's the author of Making the Most of Your Money. Why is it that at this time when so many people have lost their jobs and so many other people are afraid of losing them, and obviously so many Americans are really afraid to spend money right now or have no money to spend, why is it that last week the stock market hit a new high? What's going on?
Well, what's going on again is lower interest rates. People who have been keeping their savings or keeping their investments in the bank in certificates of deposit that are coming due, and they are looking at the new rates, they're saying just what you and I have been talking about, Terry. They've been saying, you know, I don't want to get 4% on my next CD. And the fact is, this is money that I can afford to put out for a little risk. I probably am not going to need it for 5 years or more, so I'm going to go and buy some stocks. Typically, when interest rates decline, stock values go up because people, they just look at what they're getting on their CDs and they say, this is ridiculous. And so they become willing to take a risk.
Do you mind my asking, are you making any big changes with your personal portfolio now that the interest rates are down?
Yeah, I've been buying some more stock owning mutual funds. Exactly, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I always take my own advice, Terry. I mean, to me, I know that the stock market is clearly at a high. There is clearly a risk here, but here's how I invest. And I've got about, you know, I'm middle-aged. I've got a portion of my money in safe places in treasury securities and medium-term bonds, just as we're talking about. And I have the majority of my money is invested for risk, but what it's for growth. So what I do is I have a regular investment program. So every month I put some money in stock-owning mutual funds. And I have not stopped doing that, even though the stock market is high, because these are simply investments that I expect to have for a long period of time. And so I'm actually putting some more in it because CDs turned over and I don't want to do another CD at 4%. I mean, it's just what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So I invested it for growth even though the market is high. Market may collapse 6 months from now. If it does, I'm going to invest even more because this is my long-term money. I'm not going to touch this money for 15 years at least. In fact, I actually hope the market goes down because then I can get stocks cheaper than I can get them today. But this is what I'm doing.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jane Bryant Quinn. She writes about personal finance. Her latest book is called Making the Most of Your Money.
You know, Terry, I might just add on this when we're talking about, you ask me what kind of things I'm buying. I am also looking very closely at the stock-owning mutual funds that buy the stocks of the European companies. And I think that people ought to do that when we're looking at the growth potential of the U.S. economy versus the growth potential of Europe over the next few years. I think the growth potential of Europe is much higher than it is in the United States. I think we're going to have several very slow years while everybody pays off their debts. You know, the growth that we should have had in the early 1990s, we sort of tucked into the 1980s. So we had this terrific 1980s, and we're going to have a very slow early 1990s, I think. Over in Europe, they're not. They're having really terrific growth. And so part of the money that I am investing in stocks, I am investing in mutual funds that buy stocks in Europe.
That's interesting. So you I guess there are mutual funds that do that.
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of mutual funds. And there are a lot of funds that invest in individual countries, like you invest in Germany or invest in France. I don't buy those. I buy funds that are very broadly invested in European stocks as a whole. Again, I'm very conservative, and so I kind of go for very broad, diversified investments on a regular investment program. But I really do think that there is going to be a lot of growth in Europe, and that's something that you should be putting at least some of your long-term growth money into.
Speaking of Europe, I've been reading that the dollar is heading to record lows against the mark. What about the rest of Europe? Is the dollar really bad against
the
other
dollar
currencies?
The value of the dollar has been going down, and this ties right in with your interest rates questions, because when the interest rate in the United States goes down and the interest rates in other countries stay high, then the value of the dollar goes down because people sort of sell their dollars. They can get a better return by investing in marks or investing in francs or whatever. So you get a declining dollar. So as long as the pressure is down on interest rates here, dollar is going to continue to decline. Now, for people who invest in Europe, when the dollar declines, that improves their return on investment because their foreign investments become worth more in terms of U.S. currency. This means, conversely, when the dollar goes up again, as it eventually will, that there will be that the value of European investments will not be as good as they are now. But still, I think that the growth potential in Europe is so much that it will probably overcome any change in value when the dollar starts going up again. And don't ask me when that'll be, because I haven't a clue again. Just the way you don't have a clue about interest rates, you don't have a clue about when the dollar is going to turn around.
Given that the dollar is not very favorable now compared to European currency, if you are lucky enough to have enough money to travel, it sounds like this would be a very bad time to do it.
If anybody who has gone to Europe lately, and I haven't gone to Europe in a while, but some of my friends have, it is unbelievably expensive. This, by the way, it's such a turnaround for me, because years ago when I first went to Europe, it used to be we'd say, gee, Europe is so cheap. There are these fabulous bargains. The dollar is worth so much. You'd go and you'd shop and you'd get all these fabulous things and you'd come back laden with stuff. Now it's exactly the reverse. If you travel to Europe, I mean, a cup of coffee can cost you $3. But the Europeans come over here and they say, oh, you know, New York is so cheap. The United States is so cheap, and they load up and they buy stuff over here. So it's sort of exactly the opposite of the experience that I used to have. However, this is bad for travelers, American travelers to Europe, but it is very good for the American economy, because we are a lot of the strength that we have had in the economy in this past year has come from exports, because American goods are now very cheap abroad, and so people are buying them, and you're seeing American manufacturing in the Middle West improving, and because a lot of American capital goods are being shipped to Europe and other places. So the lower dollar is very good for companies as they export, as they sell abroad.
So, Jane, let me change the subject on you. Do you have any New Year's resolutions that you're making?
Well, New Year's resolutions, yeah, I'm going to lose weight. All right. That incidentally,
I thought you were going to say I'm going to lose money.
I'm going to lose weight.
That was a bad resolution.
No, I'm going to lose weight. The Gallup poll did a survey very recently about New Year's resolutions, and the number one New Year's resolution is a perennial, and that is lose weight, and that is mine, of course, especially after the holiday season. Interestingly enough, the number two resolution this year is organizing your personal finances, and this is the first time that's happened. I talked to the people who did these kinds of polls, and they say usually organizing your finances is number six or seven in New Year's resolutions. And this year, for the first time, it's moved up to number two. So I think that's a sign of the times. You know, people are saying, I'm not making it. Whatever I was doing before is not right. I'm taking another look at my money, and I'm going to figure out how to make it work better for 1992. I really found that kind of a fascinating finding.
Well, Jane Bryan Quinn, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's always fun.
And I wish you a very happy New Year.
Thank you, and a happy New Year to you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Jane Bryan Quinn writes about personal finance. Her latest book is called Making the Most of Your Money. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've gotten down to my last pair of shoes. Can't even win a nickel bet because of them that's got them that gets, and I ain't got nothing yet. I'm sneaking in and out, ducking my landlord. All I seem to do is stay in debt because of them that's got, yeah, them that gets, and I tell y'all, I ain't got nothing yet. That old saying, them that's got are them that gets it.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Our film critic Stephen Schiff thinks 1991 got off to a pretty bad start. But he's managed to find 12 films worth squeezing into his 10 best list. Coming up, we'll talk about his choices. This evening, ABC is presenting part two of the restored version of Spartacus. If you've ever wondered why British actors like Laurence Olivier and Charles Laughton play the Roman rulers, while ethnic Americans like Kirk Douglas and Tony Curtis play the slaves, you'll be interested in hearing linguist Jeff Nunberg's thoughts on the subject. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Two former Soviet republics are reported to be on the verge of civil war as Commonwealth leaders discuss security and defense policies in Minsk. Fighting was reported in Georgia and Azerbaijan, and leaders have warned that the violence is spreading. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Moscow.
In Georgia, troops loyal to the republic's president, Zvyan Gamsakhurdia, have forced rebel fighters away from the parliament building where fighting has been raging for a week now. But the rebel forces said today they are preparing another assault on the parliament. Several hundred Afghan war veterans, meanwhile, are reportedly ready to join the fighting on the rebel side. The rebels are trying to force Gamsakhurdia to resign. An opposition leader predicted today that if the fighting continues much longer, there will be a sea of blood in Georgia. Meanwhile, violence was also spreading in the neighboring Republic of Azerbaijan. Government troops there have moved into Nagorno-Karabakh, an Armenian enclave inside Azerbaijan territory. The independent news agency Interfax reported here today that the Azeri forces have seized control of hills surrounding the main town in the Armenian enclave and are shelling it. I'm Tom Gelton in Moscow.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin says that leaders of 11 former Soviet republics have agreed to let each state have its own army. Yeltsin said the conventional force question was the toughest one faced at a meeting of the new Commonwealth. He said that compromises were made over whether or not to keep conventional forces unified. The meeting also agreed on a permanent unified command over nuclear warheads, and Yeltsin said that he is taking control of the nuclear button, but would not use it before consulting with three other states holding nuclear materials. Heavy fighting is continuing in many parts of Croatia as the Serbian-led Federal Army steps up its attacks. Pierre Vickery reports that hundreds of shells and missiles have fallen over the last 24 hours on Karlovac.
Tens of thousands of civilians have been forced to spend most of the day in cellars and air raid shelters as the Yugoslav army maintains its 10-day assault on the town of Karlovac. Zagreb Radio said hundreds of explosions shook the city, causing major damage to schools, hospitals and apartment blocks and destroying large parts of the town's infrastructure. Many residents are without electricity or water, and the town's central heating system has been put out of action. Heavy fighting is also reported in central Croatia, with both the Serbian and Croatian-led armies claiming major successes. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed more than 62 points to close at 3,163.91 on volume of 245 million shares. Trading was heavy. This is NPR News. Mother Teresa is hospitalized in La Jolla, California. Officials say that the 81-year-old Catholic nun was hospitalized with pneumonia and later suffered heart failure and underwent a procedure to unclog coronary arteries. She became ill last week in Mexico while on a world tour of missionaries of charity facilities. She is listed in serious condition. Three human rights groups today said that the Bush administration has recently become silent about abuses in Haiti to make it easier for U.S. officials to argue that boat people should be forcibly returned there. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
A federal judge has temporarily barred the forced return of Haitians, but the administration is trying to have that order reversed, arguing that 80% of the boat people should be returned because they're simply escaping poverty. And when they are returned, they face no persecution, the administration says. That's not true, according to a report by America's Watch, Physicians for Human Rights, and the National Coalition for Haitian Refugees. Ann Fuller.
People who have been returned to Haiti since the coup began have been interrogated by the police, had their fingerprints taken. It's not clear whether all of them were freed or not. It's difficult to find these things out.
Today's report says Haiti is undergoing the worst repression since the ruthless dictatorships of Papa Doc and Baby Doc Duvalier. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
A car bomb explosion in Beirut has killed at least 15 people and wounded more than 100 others. The explosion was called the worst in Lebanon in more than 6 years. The bomb destroyed nearby buildings and started fires near an intersection filled with vendors and shoppers. Police sources indicated that while no one has claimed responsibility for the blast, it may have been planned to set back government efforts to take control in the country after years of civil war. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has put together his list of the best films of 1991, and we're going to talk about his choices. But Stephen thinks perhaps the most interesting thing we watched this year was Real Life.
Well, you know what the most remarkable thing about the year was? The culture wasn't taking place in the culture. It was taking place in real life. You know, the most amazing cultural events, the things that were just as amazing to us as the best books or the best movies or the best TV shows, and more so, were the Gulf War on TV, of course, the Soviet coup, the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings, and the William Kennedy Smith rape trial. These things took their place in our cultural lives, not just in our sort of news life. Because we were talking about them as though they were plots, that we were talking about them as though, you know, what's going to happen next? Who are these characters? That kind of thing. And we were discussing the issues that they raise the way we discuss the issues that books and movies and TV raise. And I think that is not just an expression of this being an unusually kind of packed year news-wise. I think that this year reflected a kind of exhaustion with fiction. You know, we have more stories being told to us than any culture in history. We have more TV shows, we have more books, we have more movies. Even within the TV shows, we have commercials that tell little stories that make us cry when we reach out to touch someone or what have you. We know every narrative trick in the book. We know what's going to happen. We know who committed the murder before the murder's committed. And to see real life instead fooling us and being unpredictable and having characters who had problems we hadn't seen before, our sophistication with fiction sort of had become overwhelming. And now real life proved that there was some way in which we could become excited again by a story if the story wasn't being told to us by a storyteller.
See, my worry is that all the real events that we watch this year we'll be watching as made-for-TV movies next year.
You're absolutely right about that. I mean, these people know a good thing when they see it. And they are manufacturers, after all, the fiction makers. They are manufacturers.
Yeah, well, I don't want to see what washed-up stars they get to play Gorbachev and Yeltsin and Clarence Thomas
Joan
and Anita
Collins
Hill.
Joan Collins says Rice and Gorbachev. I can see it.
Well, Stephen, let's get to your choices for the best films of the year, and the 10 best list just expanded to 12.
Yeah, exactly.
So we should get started with them. Do you want to do them in any order?
I'll do them in alphabetical order.
Oh, so we can have a drum roll before you get to the last letters of the alphabet.
Yeah. If you wish.
Yeah.
All right, well, so we start with B, which is Beauty and the Beast, then Black Robe, Bugsy, Europa, Europa, Life is Sweet, Naked Lunch, Paris is Burning, Rush, The Silence of the Lambs, Thelma and Louise, Truly, Madly, Deeply, and The Vanishing.
Let me ask you about a couple of films that I have a feeling our listeners aren't familiar with. Let's go to Black Robe. Tell us something about the movie. I think it's mostly been playing at art houses and might not have even reached some cities that our listeners are in.
Yeah, that's right. It's Bruce Beresford's movie about early missionaries in the Canadian territories dealing with Indians who have never seen white men before. And these are Catholic missionaries. It's an amazingly powerful, bleak, beautiful, sort of awesome film. And all that despite the fact that there are no likable characters in it, the least of all the lead, Lothair Bluto, who plays a priest who's really sort of twisted by his faith, and a very distant, repellent character. And yet what he goes through and what all the characters in this movie go through will leave you really stunned. I think it's a brilliant, underrated movie.
And The Vanishing?
The Vanishing opened very early in 91, maybe January or February. It's a Dutch film by a man named George Slyzer. And it's a real thriller, a real kind of a murder thriller, almost perfectly made. A very small movie, as most of these on my list are. I think you'll agree they're mostly small gems. This is almost perfectly executed thriller, and I hope it comes back or can be found on video.
I can't wait to see Naked Lunch. This is the David Cronenberg adaptation of William Burroughs' work. It's on your list, so you must think it's very good.
Oh, I think it's very good. I think, you know, it's one of the most unlikely triumphs of the year. It's you know, an impossible project, this sprawling, crazy book by William Burroughs. How do you do it? How do you take these visions that don't make any sense and turn them into a narrative? The obvious way would be to use William Burroughs' life as your narrative and integrate them. But the way David Cronenberg does this is so kind of seamless and light and fast and funny and strange. It's a perfect melding of these two peculiar sensibilities, Cronenberg's and Burroughs, and absolutely faithful to both.
And I'll remind our listeners that David Cronenberg also directed Dead Ringers and Scanners.
So The Fly.
And The Fly, yeah. So he's got a really interesting sensibility.
Yeah, really creepy. This is, of course, a movie, as they say, not for the squeamish. It has bodily fluids and monsters and all done on a very sort of high intellectual level, strangely enough. I mean, which is where Cronenberg works. He makes sort of horror movies for the thinking man and woman.
Well, I'll be there. I've got to ask you about Thelma and Louise, Stephen. I've been meaning to talk to you about this movie. I hated this movie. And I thought, you know, everybody was trumpeting it as being this really feminist film. And I thought it's such phony Hollywood feminism. I mean, the message is if you have a husband who behaves more like your warden than your mate, and he's stupid and unattractive to boot, then it would be liberating to leave. Are we that backwards that in 1991 we applaud that message as a serious feminist statement?
No, that's certainly not the reason why I applaud Thelma and Louise. I rarely applaud or decry a film based on its message. Messages are what the movies give us on the most simplistic level.
Well, touche, I'll mention then that it was boring and it was an action film that lacked action.
I didn't think it was an action film. It was a road movie, and you won't say it lacked road. And I think it was not boring. I thought the vision that it created of a universe run by men, politics aside, feminism aside, was beautiful and convincing. Brought to amazing life by the cinematographer Adrian Biddle, who showed that a kind of there's almost a masculinist viewpoint that could be taken, because he shows the unity of the landscape that men have made their own of oil derricks and trucks and roads to nowhere, the unity of that landscape with the natural kind of physiognomy of the earth, with Monument Valley cliffs and faceless deserts and everything else. I thought it was really a picture of these two women kind of alone on the face of a bewildering planet, and that's what was powerful about it to me.
Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff is with us. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're reviewing the year in film with Fresh Air film critic Stephen Schiff. Silence of the Lambs. This is a movie that came out early in the year. A lot of people forget those early movies by the time they're making up their 10 best list. What's the lasting impact the film had on you?
Well, I thought it was a beautiful movie, and people were sort of scared by it and scared to go see it, and I think found themselves coming out of it not only having had a great entertaining time, but also inexplicably moved. And I think the reason for that is that Silence of the Lambs works on a mythic level that's almost perfectly. It's not the story just of horrible killers and the girl who gets them. It's a story of a woman's search for herself along a classic path, which is to say someone who's young and needs to find the truth, the inner truth and the outer truth, and needs to do so by going on a quest. The quest is to slay the dragon, and in this case, a psychopathic killer. And always on these quests that heroes and heroines take, you have to come upon a mentor, and the mentor is dangerous and seductive, and the mentor can destroy you or seduce you and give you information and make you stronger. And, of course, that's the Anthony Hopkins character, Hannibal Lecter. And this search for self, the search for knowledge that threads its way through the Silence of the Lambs makes it incredibly poignant, I think, and gives it a lasting resonance that at least the New York film critics remembered when they announced that it was their choice for the best film of the year.
Now, Paris is Burning is on your 10 best list. Describe what this movie's about. It's a documentary.
This is a terrific, also strangely moving documentary about houses, they're called, in Harlem, of transvestites who dress up, who are so much the underclass in this society that they're not just dressing up, they're not just men dressing up as women, but sometimes they're men dressing up as men. But instead of dressing up, they're dressing up as ordinary men. They find themselves so outside of the world that they see that to pass for instance, a businessman is a triumph to them. And they have parties and contests and all sorts of things that you watch in this movie. And it's an overwhelming sort of cultural experience. It's amazing to see that right next door to you, this world of outsiders feels so outside that they develop this extremely rich and vibrant subculture to make up for it.
Let me point out that if we're talking about any movies that you've missed, chances are that they're already out on video or they'll be out on video in the near future. So if any of these films are films that didn't come to your local movie houses, don't forget your local video store if you want to see them. Now, a movie that either just opened or hasn't opened yet, depending on where you are, is Rush, and this is based on a memoir by Kim Wozencraft. I've only seen The Coming Attractions. It's on your 10 best list. Tell us something about the movie.
Well, I should tell you first that the director, Lily Zanuck, is a friend of mine. I should just say that to qualify my remarks. But I think she did a remarkable job, and this is her first film as a director. She was a producer with her husband, Dick Zanuck, of, among other things, Driving Miss Daisy. And she's taken this novel and made it into a very powerful movie that is absolutely no holds barred. There's not a moment of sentimentality. There's not a moment of compromise in it. And she gets powerful performances out of Jason Patric, whom you may have thought of earlier as kind of just a pretty boy, but he brings to the movies a quality among young actors that I feel we really need and lack at the moment, with the likes of Kevin Costner dominating the scene. And that quality is danger. He really has a kind of movie star danger that I find wonderful to watch. There are great performances. There's an almost wordless performance that's absolutely powerful by Greg Allman in it as the villain. And Max Perlick, a wonderful actor whom you may remember from Drugstore Cowboy, gives one of the best supporting performances of the year in this movie.
What was his role in Drugstore Cowboy?
He was the guy who finally killed Matt Dillon.
Oh, okay. So I interrupted you.
Well, I just think it's a terrific job and a strong, maybe too harsh movie. I mean, it is about the drug subculture. You are watching people stick needles into their arms, and you're watching pretty scary things happen. People get blown away. It's set in the 70s in a kind of grungy, seedy world. It's not Hook, believe me, but I think we need antidotes to Hook, and this is one.
Okay, we should mention Europa.
I
ended up seeing this one twice for various reasons, and I really enjoyed it the second time around because it was so well edited that it's the kind of thing you don't see when you're watching the movie the first time.
No, that's right. It's a beautifully made movie from first to last, and I can't rate it too highly. Maybe it's the best movie of the year. I don't know. It's a marvel, and really, this is... In this year when truth was often stranger than fiction, the verity of the story, the fact that it was a true story and that it's the story of the strange kind of survival of this man named Solomon Peril through World War II, a Jewish man, a Jewish boy who posed as a Nazi and got away with it. And when you see the real character it's based on in Israel at the end, there's an almost kind of there's a terrible beauty about it that just haunts you for weeks and months afterwards. This is not to say that the only powerful image in this film is the last one. It's got it from beginning to end.
Tell me what you think of my theory. I think that this year in movies was the year of the life force. Movies where somebody who's not very bright is a little naive but has this zest for life.
What do you think?
Brings the zest into other people's lives, and we're all better people by virtue of having seen the movie. In this category, I'd put like Laura Dern in Rambling Rose, Robin Williams in The Fisher King, yes, mm-hmm. Jodie Foster in Little Man Tate, where she's not as smart as everyone else, but she's got this zest for life. Gina Davis in Thelma and Louise.
So I'm terribly afraid you have a good point here. if I detect an edge of disgust in your description, I share it. Also, that kind of rings with the redemption theme in these movies. I mean, another example, maybe the most egregious of what you're talking about, is regarding Henry, where a bad man is turned into one of your life force characters by a bullet to the head. And, of course, we could all be as wonderful as he was if we all just went out and got shot. I think this is an alarming trend, very 90s, I find, where kind of how everyone is falling backwards, falling all over themselves backwards to be kind of dumb and good instead of hyper-sophisticated the way we felt we were in the 80s and now feel guilty about.
Huh. Do you think that there was a proportionately large share of bad films this year? How would you rate the year?
Yes, I did think there was a proportionately large share of bad films. In fact, as of sort of the summer, it seemed to me I'd seen three good movies out of zillions. And this is the plight that the film critic finds himself in now sort of universally, is that there are more movies being dumped on the film market for various reasons, not least of which is that you need to, in order to go to video, have it play somewhere. And often the place that it plays is New York City. And so we find ourselves being dragged to screenings of just terrible, terrible stuff. And I think in economic hard times, you always have a kind of play-it-safe mentality. The film business is, after all, a business. If there's a formula to be grabbed, they grab the formula. And so you get a lot of movies that are samey and are uninspired and that may begin to go somewhere but don't finally arrive there because it's too scary to go all the way. And yes, I mean, these are all the movies on my top dozen, shall we say, are small, kind of peculiar. It's almost as though they've escaped from the pack. You know, someone wasn't looking close enough, and they managed to get away with being good. But I found this year really disheartening in many respects.
So, Stephen, what are you doing New Year's Eve?
New Year's Eve, we're having friends over, and we're popping some corks.
Well, I hope you have a good time. And I wish you a very happy New Year.
Absolutely the same to you.
And I hope there's some good movies for us to see in 1992.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Thanks for being with us, Stephen.
Sure, pleasure.
Stephen Schiff reviews movies for Fresh Air, and he's critic at large at Vanity Fair. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what news do you have from what we're now calling the Commonwealth of Independent States?
Well, the leaders of those states are meeting in what we now call Minsk, in what we now call Belarus, used to be Minsk, Belarusia. And today they agreed on a common military command for their nuclear weapons for at least a couple of months. We'll hear about that. Also, an author who's written a book about Boris Yeltsin talks about the new Russian leader. And to talk with Samir Khalil, the Iraqi expatriate critic, dissident, who this past year made his first return back to Iraq in 20 years to investigate charges of systematic murder of the Kurds.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. I was watching the restored version of Spartacus on TV last night, and I thought back to a commentary that Fresh Air linguist Jeff Nunberg did for us about 4 years ago. The subject was accents in Hollywood epics. We thought you'd enjoy hearing this.
Hollywood didn't used to care much about the authenticity of movie accents. Claude Rains talked the same way whether he was playing an English rake, a French policeman, or a senator from Montana. And nobody seemed to mind that Clark Gable played Fletcher Christian in Mutiny on the Bounty, with vowels that could only have been shaped in Ohio, and with never a word of explanation. Yet, curiously, casting directors did used to pay attention to accents in certain films, and precisely those in which accents should have been entirely irrelevant. Take the ancient Roman costume epics that flourished until the 1950s, Quo Vadis, Spartacus, The Robe, and so forth. There were strict linguistic conventions in these films, which, needless to say, had nothing to do with the Latin or Hebrew of the period. The Roman patricians had to be played by British actors like Peter Ustinov or Laurence Olivier. The heroes, Christians, slaves, gladiators, depending on the film, the heroes were played by Americans like Kirk Douglas or Charlton Heston. And in the roles of apostles, you had to have Jews or Irishmen, almost always either Sam Jaffe or Finlay Curry. This casting was crucial to the key scene in all these movies, when a Roman patrician, say, was interrogating a young Christian girl. The captain has these impeccable West End vowels, and he says something like, "This Nazarene you speak of, how many legions has he?" And the Christian girl answers, 12, my lord. 12 legions? Why have I not heard of them? 12 men, my lord. 12 men? Why, what are 12 men against all that is Rome? Of course, sometimes box office realities intruded in the casting process. But in these films, unlike Mutiny on the Bounty, say, you had to put something in the script that would explain away the oddity. In Spartacus, for example, Gene Simmons was cast as a Christian. Her British accent was explained by making her a British slave. Never mind that the British in those days were wild tribesmen who liked to paint themselves blue and dance around the local henge. You weren't supposed to inquire too deeply into these things. In fact, these movies used accents to explain the difference between Christians and Romans, which, as it happens, was just like the difference between Americans and Europeans. As the American poet Randall Jarrell put it, they are smarter than we, and we are better than they. Their sophistication has, unfortunately, made them bad, just as our naivete has, fortunately, kept us good. Nowadays, of course, movie accents in general are supposed to be naturalistic. When they remade Mutiny on the Bounty in 1962, Marlon Brando was required to play Fletcher Christian with a British accent, which he apparently produced by knitting his eyebrows together until his adenoids screamed in pain. And by way of revenge, we've had to listen to actors like Lawrence Harvey and Albert Finney giving us their versions of American speech. But curiously, the linguistic conventions of fantasy have survived. True, the evil empires of recent movies are operating out of Death Stars rather than the Seven Hills of Rome. Yet even in far-off galaxies, evidently, the Force tends to favor those who pronounce their R's.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Richard Parker. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, words and music by Dave Frischberg. We end 1991 with a concert by one of today's wittiest songwriters, who also happens to be a great pianist. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.